ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When was the last time you really looked at your kettle, your umbrella, the hallway mirror, or even a gravestone? Every one of them was designed by someone for a reason. And those choices are still shaping how you live. The ordinary isn't ordinary at all. That's By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Find it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Time for a very special science show. Why is it now good to know how long ago people first arrived in Australia? Much earlier than once we thought. Well, it not only gives a finer, even exciting view of the wide brown land, such knowledge has even changed the law, monumentally with land rights, as with Wick and Mabo at the High Court. And as for knowing about our glorious animals, they're not leftovers at the arse end of the globe. They are unique, special. Wait till you hear about the big, surprising brain of the echidna in next week's science show. Meet my country. Poet Dorothea McKellar was right about the sunburnt country 100 years ago. And this week, in that spirit of recognition, another work, The First Inventors, a book, How People Shaped a Continent, is published summarising the new discoveries, showing again that Australia is so very special. The authors are Billy Griffiths of Deakin University, Larissa Berendt, presenting Speaking Out on ABC Radio National, and distinguished Professor Sean Ulm at James Cook University in Cairns. But we begin at Cambridge with Professor Jack Ashby and Richard Feidler. Is Australia really maligned?
A large part of your book is about this odd disdain for Australia's wildlife. It's historic, really. You hear it from Americans, you hear it from the British, you hear it from Europeans as well, where Australia's wildlife is seen as kind of primitive. It's a really kind of an odd, irritating thing I find every time I've gone to America. Americans will say, oh, I can't possibly go to Australia. I'll get killed in 5 seconds. Everything in Australia is trying to kill you. What do you make of all that, this culture of Australia is like the junkyard of God's mistakes?
So I think, absolutely. I think those two things you just described, the kind of everything is trying to kill you and the primitive idea, are both very much intertwined. So that these are both ways of writing off Australian mammals, but it's a hangover from a colonial mindset. If you read any 19th century description or 18th century description of Australian mammals, they are all, without exception, describing them as lesser mammals, of lower, inferior, primitive indeed, in being seen as being different to the kind of zoological standard of the animals they were familiar with in Europe and the Americas.
But they're letting down the side.
They're using this zoological standard, and simply by being different to a placental mammal, like a cow or a human, they were just written off as being inferior to it. And I think it very much was tied into the colonial project of putting down everything in Australia, the people, the landscape and habitat and climate and the wildlife. And by tying the wildlife into this terra nullius argument that there is nothing there of value, it helped justify the invasion. And as I say, every single scientific description is saying these are strange, weird, primitive, inferior animals. And where that the kind of everything is trying to kill you comes in, I think it's absolutely bonkers.
I always say to Americans, you've got bears in your country, man. They're like sharks that can walk on land.
Exactly.
And
that,
they come
exactly
into your backyard that. And eat your trash. I mean, no sharks. It's like, are you crazy? It's like, it's really weird.
Yeah, other than Europe, or at least parts of Europe, Australia is the only continent that doesn't have any large land predators. It is the safest place. I've spent the last couple of weeks in Tasmania on fieldwork, and I'd be out every night on my own in the forest, spotlighting for animals with absolutely no fear that I'm going to get eaten by a tiger or a bear or a wolf at any point.
Your toe won't get nibbled off by a Tasmanian devil?
Well, it's pretty unlikely, unfortunately. Yeah.
And then Richard Feidler reads Professor Ashby a poem about a roo, and it's another blatant insult.
There are others like Baron Field, who wrote this poem called Kangaroo. I'm just going to quote the first stanza of it for you. It might be the only stanza, actually. He came here in 1816 to serve as a judge. He wrote, "Kangaroo, kangaroo, thou spirit of Australia that redeems from utter failure, from perfect desolation, and warrants the creation of this fifth part of the earth, which would seem an afterbirth, not conceived in the beginning, for God blessed his work at first, and saw that it was good, but emerged at the first sinning, when the ground was therefore cursed, and hence this barren wood. Imagine arriving in Australia and just going, well, this is God's junkyard like this. It's an extraordinary thing. This is really a widespread phenomenon, you found.
It is, absolutely, throughout the 19th century and 20th century. But actually, I think it harks on today in that if you go to any museum, hopefully outside of Australia, you go to any museum, or read any newspaper article about Australian mammals, particularly platypuses, or, you know, watch a TV documentary, the trope is, these are strange animals. They are weird. Weird and wonderful, but nonetheless weird. And no other continent, another large part of the world, has its wildlife treated in this way.
Dr. Jack Ashby, Professor of Zoology at Cambridge, famous for his book Platypus Matters. And that was on Conversations with Richard Feidler, ABC Radio National. But what about people in Australia, once thought to have arrived almost by accident so recently? One of our authors of The First Inventors, Larissa Berendt, puts it this way.
We have to value, be curious about, and build on our ancient wisdoms. One of the most hurtful aspects of the debate around the 2023 referendum was the re-emergence of the tired and insulting narrative that Aboriginal people are somehow stone-aged. What is so often missing is curiosity about how we became and remain the world's oldest continuous culture, a legacy of knowledge, resilience, and innovation that should be a source of national pride. You do not get to be considered the world's oldest living continuous culture by luck. For tens of thousands of years, Aboriginal people lived on this continent sustainably and adjusting to change. But to me, that's not even the most wondrous part of what my culture today represents. As I see my Yuwalari community come together, learning our language, connecting with country, claiming our native title, regenerating our cultural practices, I marvel not just that my culture has survived 65,000 plus years, but that it has survived everything that colonisation has thrown at us over the last couple of centuries. Surely there is strength and resilience in that, which should inspire us to help find solutions to the challenges we are collectively facing today, including climate change and threats to our democracy. Indigenous knowledge systems are not simply cultural artefacts. They are sophisticated intellectual traditions. They offer ways of thinking rooted in sustainability, reciprocity, interconnection and care for country. They value the wisdom of male and female elders, lived experience and collective problem solving. Imagine if these philosophies were centred in how we govern, educate and respond to crisis. Our debates about democracy have too often been confined to the narrow horizons of European thought, framed by the philosophies of French and British men from a few centuries ago. That lineage has given us important ideals, but it has also limited our imagination. What if, instead, we went further back? What if we drew on the oldest continuing cultures in the world? On First Nations knowledge systems that value consensus, responsibility to community, and deep care for country. Including First Nations worldviews would not just enrich our democracy, it would transform it, broadening it beyond the confines of Western liberal traditions and grounding it in values of respect, reciprocity, and shared survival. This is the conversation that could carry our democracy into a more inclusive and enduring future. The concept of interdependence reminds us that no nation, no community, and no individual can face the climate crisis alone. It asks us to see our connections to each other, to the natural world, and to the generations that will follow, not as vulnerabilities, but as sources of strength.
Boyer lecturer Larissa Berendt, one of the three authors of The First Inventors, published this week. But what about human arrival? The vague recent story was that just a few human beings turned up almost by accident on the north coast of Australia. Signs of habitation were found, and at a cave called Mujabibi in the Northern Territory, dates of people living there were put at about 65,000 years ago. Then much deeper exploration was led by a new centre of excellence in the north at Cairns, and further finds on a massive scale were discovered. Here's one of the archaeologists up there, Ariane Lambridis, finding even the tiniest of clues. What's been one or two of the most exciting things you found in your explorations?
In terms of an object, I would say would be during my PhD, and we found this really beautiful tiny pearlfish hook, which we interpreted as maybe it was made by a child or somebody learning to make fish hooks. And that was really exciting, I think, because I think sometimes we forget those stories attached to the objects we're finding and thinking about, like, an individual learning the technique of making a fish hook, like sitting by the coast with somebody and learning those skills. Since I've been working in Australia, I would say being involved definitely in the Yiguru or the Lizard Island project and being part of that team that found pottery dated to 2,500 years ago, the first example of Aboriginal people making pottery in Australia. That was a real privilege to be part of that bigger team.
Great coup. Now, you're also called the chief investigator. What does that mean?
What does it mean indeed? So I am a chief investigator with the ARC Centre of Excellence for Indigenous and Environmental Histories and Futures. Bit of a mouthful, that one. So I'm one of 20, so there's a few of us. And we're part of a bigger team that's looking at developing co-designed research, so with our eight Indigenous partner organisations, to look 1,000 years into the past and think about the ways that together, as part of that co-design research process, that we can use that really valuable deep time information then to inform the management of country, you know, into 1,000 years into the future effectively. So I'm part of that broader team that's getting to do that really exciting work all over Australia.
And when you talk to Indigenous communities like that, do you have any difficulty interpreting what these old stories actually mean? In other words, does it make sense to you with practice to hear these stories?
I think often what's so remarkable is these kind of added layers that are always contributed by having that Indigenous knowledge part of the story. The fact that from the beginning we are partners, the research questions are developed with community, everything we're doing is designed with community. And then because of that kind of capacity to take Indigenous knowledge alongside whatever scientific methods that we're implementing, to be able to tell, I think, a much richer and fuller story. So I would say it's all very complementary. And sometimes they tell a different story, but that's wonderful too, I think. It's all part of the richness.
You don't think, oh, well, that's just a legend. It's not the sort of science I'm looking for, or do you?
No. I mean, I wouldn't say I personally think that. Yeah, those stories are so central to being able to interpret the archaeological record because we're so limited. At the end of the day, these communities have been in these places for thousands of years and have these tremendous stories and knowledge and have so much to share. And I'm all the richer for being able to hear those stories.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ariane Lambridis with the Centre of Excellence up in Cairns, Northern Queensland. And so, what have they found? What is the big new story? Here's Distinguished Professor Sean Ulm, who leads the Centre of Excellence and helped write The First Inventors.
Well, I think it's a brilliant book. I've read it more than once. And one of the things that really startled me in the first few pages is the discussion of human beings being here for 65,000 years and the cave in the Northern Territory called Mujabibi. And you ask the question, where was this cave 65,000 years ago? And the answer is 350 kilometres inland. What was the implication of that?
I think this speaks to a bigger story. And one of the reasons we wrote the book actually is to get the public more engaged with our own history of the continent. And one of the most astounding things when I do public speaking and training and things, getting people to envisage a continent when the sea levels are 130 metres lower than they are today. And the reality is that for the majority of the human history of our continent, it didn't look anything like it does today. So if you lower the sea level by 130 metres, it exposes all of the continental shelves around Australia and connects what we now know as Australia to both Tasmania and New Guinea to form the supercontinent of Sahul. And that's how we find Majabibi, 350 kilometres inland at the time it was first occupied, maybe before 65,000 years ago.
You're being very gentle. It's clearly more than 65,000 years ago, I would have thought.
Well, I think this is something, Robin, you and I have talked about before, this conservatism about the age of the people of the continent. And certainly over my career, that's crept upwards from 40,000 years 30 years ago to 45,000 years to 50,000 years and grudgingly, you know, maybe 51,000 years. And we've known that Majabibi is much older than that for a long time. In fact, back in early 1990s, my colleague Bert Roberts led a study showing that those sites were at least 55, 60,000 years ago. But there was a real pushback against accepting those arguments because the prevailing view was that Australia can't have been colonised that long ago.
As we speak, the evidence from various parts, say, of the islands of Indonesia, cave paintings, bones, all sorts of things, giving more and more clues, and some not published yet from other parts, even in Australia. So in other words, the story of human beings in Australia seems to be mounting to be a much greater age.
I think that's right. I mean, I think one of the objections to accepting an early age for the peopling of Australia was there was no sites of that age or older in Wallacea, in the islands between the Southeast Asian mainland and Australia. And the argument from people who were inclined to think of a much shorter age for the peopling of Australia was, well, show me the archaeological evidence for these places in the trackway, the routes that people must have migrated. And just at the end of last year, colleagues out of Griffith University published a study from Sulawesi, which furthered results we already knew about from Borneo, that art there had been created at least by 67,000 years ago. Now, that makes it the earliest art we know about in the world made by our own species, by Homo sapiens, that the only other art approaching that age is from Spain, which is attributed to Neanderthals.
Now, when you call a book The New Inventors, you're talking about all sorts of things, technology, science, and the meeting of two, maybe more, given the range of different societies around Australia, more different traditions of science. And we sometimes forget that even with the European science, you had all sorts of other different influences. Did I mention the Vatican and who knows what else, talking about matters that were not accepted later on because the evidence mounted up. How did you deal with the fact that there are different, sometimes clashes, of the culture of science and invention in this country because of the human history?
One of the things when we sat down to think about what are the central pillars of this book, and one of them was centering Indigenous voice and exploring different ways of seeing country. And underlying that was an emphasis on avoiding homogenising First Nations experiences and knowledges. And I think one of the things that, even with greater awareness of First Nations issues in public policy, in research, the experiences of First Nations peoples are often homogenised as a singular whole. But of course, like any nation, they have their own histories and knowledge systems, languages, social customs. And I think the next frontier in disciplines like archaeology and in history is actually not only acknowledging that diversity, but supporting unpacking them. So I think in answer to your question, you know, part of the way we navigated that is by honouring the integrity of each of those knowledge systems.
Was it a straightforward, or did you see clashes? Was it a variety of examples?
Look, the examples that immediately come to mind are extraordinary ones like volcanism on the Atherton Tablelands. One of the things we often forget in Australia, speaking to that long-term environmental change, is that Indigenous people were here with country when volcanoes were erupting. And not only were they here, the histories of witnessing those volcanic eruptions are preserved in Indigenous oral histories, as are the rising of the seas. And these aren't isolated incidents. We have compelling histories of Indigenous ancestors witnessing sea level rise more than 10,000 years ago at dozens of locations around the continent. So these are not happenstance ancestral memories. These are encoded histories in story and song. And in fact, they're the oldest oral traditions we know about anywhere in the world.
Isn't it interesting, because I've been up a mountain with two scientifically minded Indigenous people looking at their own traditions. And it reminded me very much of doing a degree in botany, where you were looking not just at the mountain, but these sections, only about, you know, a square metre of terrain. What's the soil like? What are the other little plants like? Not just what are the trees like, but you've got detail there, which is in the soil itself, you've got thousands of organisms. And similarly, on a tree, you've got another couple of who knows how many different organisms. And the Indigenous people knew this, and they also knew which plants you could actually light up for a white smoke. In other words, a cool fire rather than a black smoke. And they were looking at segments, sections, in the same way as I used to, being trained in modern science, so-called.
It's been a great privilege to be out on country with fire masters. So these are senior knowledge holders who understand that ecology and the effects of fire. One of the things that really stays with me is how a fire can burn, but so coolly that it doesn't penetrate the earth and kill off the life below the surface. So a fire can go through and you can literally scrape the surface of the ground and it's cool underneath, which is not what a lot of people associate with fire. And it, in the Western world, we often see fire as destructive, not creative. And I think when you make that switch to think about that creativity, it's generative and it's an act of care to burn and look after country. And certainly when I've been on country, I've been instructed to burn country to show my care and my responsibility to country.
Sean, we're talking about your book, written, of course, with two other authors, Billy Griffiths and Larissa Berendt, who presents a program on ABC Radio National. But what about the fish traps? The thing that startled me reading your book, I knew about fish traps, most listeners do, vaguely, but some of them were gigantic.
Absolutely. And this was another one of these central pillars we decided in the book, that we really wanted to highlight other countries and other examples of country that aren't in the public discourses. You know, and fish traps are a good example of those. We hear a lot about the extraordinary Brewarrina fish traps. We hear a lot about the extraordinary World Heritage listed fish traps at Budjambim in Guntijmara country in Western Victoria. But they're not the only examples of these extraordinary structures. What we're talking about are, in the main, intertidal stone-walled fish traps. So these are walls built to enclose areas of the intertidal zone to control the movements of marine resources. And in some areas, on some countries, and I'm thinking here particularly in the southern Gulf of Carpentaria, the Wellesley Islands and adjacent mainland, so that's the country of Kaida, Lardal, Yunkal and Gungalida people, we've been working with the ranger groups there and senior traditional owners to document all of those sites from satellite data. And a PhD student, Lucy Hughes, has done an extraordinary amount of work here. We've recorded over 500 individual fish traps, but that's not the most extraordinary part of it, just the number. It's the fact that those fish traps constitute more than 55 linear kilometres of stone wall, which can be more than a metre in height. And individual fish traps can be almost up to a kilometre long. So what you're looking at is an integrated system of paddocks in the intertidal zone, which constitute an aquaculture system. These are enclosing, are the biggest structures built by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and they're designed basically for producing marine resources. And I think a lot of people wouldn't be aware of these structures. And they're very common in Torres Strait as well and parts of Cape York Peninsula. But fish traps are known all around the Australian coastline, rarely in the types of densities we see in the northeast, though.
Distinguished Professor and archaeologist Sean Alm, such a scale. As seen from the sky, some of these fish traps are clearly monumental. So what about the scale of the indigenous population before Europeans arrived? Billy Griffiths is another main author of The First Inventors.
One of the most astonishing things in this amazing book is when you reveal what the population in Australia of indigenous people used to be. Millions? Is that possible?
It seems likely. It seems to be the case, which is a journey we've gone on over the past 100 years, really. So 100 years ago, Alfred Reginald Radcliffe Brown put an estimate together of about 300,000 people living in Australia at 1788, the pre-conquest population. And at the time, everyone thought, 300,000, that's far too much. In the 1980s, economic historian Noel Butland came along and thought, Radcliffe Brown's estimate doesn't account for smallpox, which was devastating. And he prepared a new estimate, marshalling all sorts of evidence, which he published in Our Original Aggressors, this book, which suggested 1.2 million people might have lived here in 1788. And these two more recent studies have exploded that, have radically recast the entire demography debate. And they put a conservative estimate of the population at around about 2.5 million at 1788. So that's not the peak. This is the mind-blowing thing. This estimate comes from combining modelling about the carrying capacity of the land, what the land and the waters ways could sustain, with historical observations, archaeological site patterns, and genetic evidence on population reconstructions. And this all comes together from lots of different competing points to produce this estimate. And that's why we can say it's a conservative estimate, because if you look at the carrying capacity alone, 3 million seems to be more on the money. And yet, Australia was part of once a much bigger continent called Sahul, which is Greater Australia, which is a third larger. So most of the time that people have lived on this continent, the continent has been a third larger than it is today. So if you go with the modellers, and this is Corey Bradshaw's team, they estimate significantly more population potentially in the deep past as well. But it's so hard to pin down these population numbers because we have so little evidence surviving today. And I'm always wary of George E.P. Box's famous line that all models are wrong, but some are useful. And these numbers about populations are useful in a few respects. And I should say this latest paper is led by Alan Williams, an archaeologist, and Sean and I, who on this book together, well, we're also part of this team coming up with this 2.5 million population estimate.
And Corey Bradshaw, of course, at Flinders University.
That's right.
In the South Australia. And one of the aspects of having a much larger population, in some ways, the picture we've got, often wrongly, of these isolated groups being on the map in complete isolation, but maybe, you know, the odd wandering and sharing of bits of language. But when you've got 3 million, obviously you can have the toing and the froing. And I often think of the Greek islands and the way in which innovation happened, suiting the land and the landscape and the sea. And that would be fostered by that sort of interaction. And in Lizard Island of northern Queensland, that's shown more and more by Sean and the pottery being discovered, because it was pottery made somewhere else and pottery made on the island. So obviously, toing and froing was going on. The picture of that Australia, so different.
Yes, Australia is far more interconnected and populous and cosmopolitan than we truly ever appreciated. There's a lot of toing and froing going on the continent. We know that from all sorts of evidence, plant translocations, moving plants from across vast distances, and then establishing new populations in new ecologies. We know that from the trading of prized goods, such as stone axes or axe heads. And we also know it from the words that are passed down and passed across regions, the language. Yeah, and this is a language that's spoken today. These are connections that are part of memory, knowledge. And this whole project has been looking at this incredible depth of knowledge that is the intimate knowledge of country that is across the continent. And I'm dancing around here because I don't want to be homogenized here. One of the big takeaways from our work has been that this incredible diversity of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's histories, cultures, words, songs, they are these independent nations, independent groups, but they are also enmeshed, deeply connected. And these connections are mediated by all sorts of diplomatic protocols. Yeah. Up in the north, where you're talking about a Yiggaroo lizard island, these connections extend beyond the borders of the continent and vastly across our region. Australia has been integrated with its region for millennia. We know that from many different sources. Pottery is interesting, and it's partly interesting because there was all these stereotypes around Aboriginal people not being able to make pottery, this kind of horrible racial lens that this shows, yes, of course, they did make it. But pottery is interesting because it speaks to this deep regional interaction. It shows us, it becomes this little clue for archaeologists in particular to look at and trace movement and exchange across the Coral Sea. It is a remarkably far-reaching, open story. And there are other sources of evidence too, which also speak to this story. And I'm always moved by the dingo as this kind of fascinating biological signature of regional interaction because it came from somewhere. It's also hard to say exactly where it came from because the genetic ancestry is all muddled up and it's all across the region. And you can't say it's just moved in from New Guinea because actually there are later dates for New Guinea singing dongs, introgression. It's a very complex genetic story. And the complexity of the genetic story is telling us that people were sharing knowledge, sharing technology, sharing ideas for several thousand years.
Yeah. 60 or more thousand years, 65,000 years. This is a gigantic period. And from what you've been saying, obviously, terra nullius, which was very, very iffy from the beginning, a bit of a legalistic device, now it looks preposterous when you actually look at the history. The land was occupied and used and involved in ways which are just stunning and varied. This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National, a special around the first inventors and the human as well as the biological history of Australia. Back to Billy Griffiths. Now you have this picture of the real history, human history. How are you going to take it around the country and discuss it with all the people who might have different views of what the history might be? You know, this is almost a revolution in a concept on Australia.
I hope people see this book as an invitation to a different way of relating to the history and the future of this continent. It is a big story. It has country at its heart, and we really unpack what country means. We feel this, and it's been a revolution for me in writing this book and in working in this space for a very long time now. It changed the way I see the country, the way I see the continent. You keep touching back onto this early arrival, and I wanted to just the 65,000-year date. This is also a history of regional interaction in some ways. So this is the new evidence that really gives us a better understanding of what the founding of the continent looked like population-wise. It couldn't have happened from someone drifting off course. In order for a population to survive on a continent, it has to pass certain extinction thresholds. And for Australia, with the size of the human population here, that is about 1,500 people arriving over a period of about 700 years. That is a purposeful, wide-scale, huge event, and it's likely to have occurred through two-way voyaging. So the voyaging to Australia was an extraordinary process of migration, evolving a deep knowledge of the skies, of navigation, going across water crossings of at least one of around about 100 kilometres where you can't see the horizon. So the story of how people came here was a story of movement, moving across, finding out what was here, and then returning and telling family. So this is the logic of two-way voyaging, which we explore in the book, which presents, again, a very different understanding of the earliest chapters of Australian history. It is a story that is diverse because 1,500 people, and these are groups of 130 at a time. So that's your extended family. You're bundling them all in. It had to be organised. It had to be purposeful. There was news going back and forth because you wouldn't bundle your entire family, a large watercraft for over the horizon voyaging, if you didn't know where you were going and have a sense of what to expect. And this is a big change in understanding, where there was not voyaging into the unknown entirely, although there was that phase. There must have been knowledge and knowledge of a back and forth. So regional exchange happening even at this very early time. And that explodes what we understand about humanity more broadly across the globe, the knowledge and the symbolic understandings that are required at this early time in history.
And I've often mentioned the fact that one of the best guides of how to get an answer of this sort of seeming clash, but it's not really a clash, is when you see the many examples of Aboriginal people and, if you like, straight professors of science working together in various places right around Australia. And you've got a person whom I've often mentioned before in Albany in Western Australia, who used to be the head of Kew Gardens, an Australian head of Kew Gardens, actually. And he's going with mainly Aboriginal women to look in the huge area in the West around him about traditions in understanding the local area, the soil and such like, and the plants and any number of other clues as to what best fire to have. Mm. So that's going on, and other experiments, and you've been there yourself around Cairns in the northern Queensland part. You have a great deal of clues of medical matters that come from trees and so on, which being followed up to explore the chemical nature of those different plants so that you can even exploit them and have some local industries up there. You know, people are working together and it shows how the meshing can take place practically.
We're talking about different knowledge systems, but it's not so much the clash, it is the partnership that it has. When these different understandings of the past come together, it changes the questions that the scientists ask. It changes the question the archaeologists ask and makes the science better. It directs the research, and also the research is done in partnership. So it begins with these conversations. What's of interest to you here, now? And then that becomes the guiding force of the research agenda, which is a cross-cultural research theme anyway. So we're seeing this more and more. I would say this partnership, which is, again, we explore these research collaborations throughout this book. These are the driving force of the new understandings that we're getting. They are exhilarating. We are learning more and different things. And it is mind-bending in many ways. It is shifting perspectives, which is a very good thing because it keeps everyone with their minds open, and also people take stuff from this research which they couldn't have fathomed. So there's a lot of pride in these histories that are collaboratively uncovered, and it's enriching the science, but it's also empowering local communities to speak for their history. It's giving them answers to the questions they want resolved. It is an ongoing process. All science is an inquiry, and this is an enriched inquiry.
Two examples to finish with, but one which doesn't arise from the book, but the question might be in the back of someone's head. I remember an occasion when Hugh Morgan from Western Mining, South Australia, who is, shall we be blunt and say, somewhat conservative person, and who's been interviewed by my colleague then, Ramona Cavall, and he said, okay, well, if Indigenous people have been in this country for all those years, why didn't they invent the wheel? You know, the standard object of a civilised and innovative culture. What's the answer?
Who made the wheel the standard, the peak of technological superiority? Indigenous people all over the continent invented extraordinary numbers of things. And I think we get this palimpsest in archaeology, just this residue of what that extraordinary technological diversity was like. And this reminds me of the Senor Lips effect. Have you heard of this?
Paleontological?
No. So the Senor Lips effect, and I need to thank my paleontological colleagues for this, is a principle that the fossil record will not preserve the youngest or the oldest example. And I often think about this in archaeology, and Madja Bibi is a good example of this. If Madja Bibi is 65,000 years or older, and it's 350 kilometres inland, it's clearly not the footprint of the first person to step foot on the continent. That the Senyalips effect principle would tell us that the first footprint is sometime earlier than that. So based on that principle, we've done modelling that shows that the first entry to the continent must have been 73 to 75,000 years ago. And I think those other forms of evidence we're talking about line up with that. The other part of that is about the cultural diversity we witness. When Europeans invaded Australia, there were at least 250 separate nations speaking different languages, up to 600 dialects. Each of those nations had its own history, culture. But when we go back in time, that 73,000, 75,000 years, I often think about this with the continental shelves, where the Gulf of Carpentaria was dry land for most of the indigenous history of the continent. There was 500 kilometres of dry land off the northwest Kimberley coast. There were generations of First Nations people who were born, lived and died on land which is now deep underwater. Those societies would have had their own technological traditions. So we've got that vector of cultural, technological, social diversity, not only spatially, but temporally as well. So we've got those traditions of invention cycling over time. And that diversity is extraordinary when you think about it. And there's nowhere else in the world that has that spatial and temporal depth of study that we have here and all of that diversity to celebrate.
And of course, if you want wheels, it helps to have roads or something like it. But the other example, sometimes conservative, he was called, Harry Butler, because he worked looking at the effects of industry on islands and so on. There's, in fact, a Harry Butler Institute at Murdoch University. And once I talked to him about, you mentioned rangers, he said that people he met in the Northern Territory, whom he worked with and whom he knew, were some of the most brilliant natural historians he'd ever come across. Quite straightforward, no cavilling. He was absolutely certain. He praised them in a wonderful way. That doesn't surprise you?
No. And in fact, this is something we were trying to achieve with the book as well, is all of us, Billy, Larissa and I, have all had extraordinary Indigenous mentors over the breadth of our careers and had that opportunity to be with country and be with knowledge holders and had our lives and our knowledges enriched by that experience. And we wanted to capture some of that in a form that we could share that joy and celebrate that knowledge with a broader population who may not have had those opportunities we've had. And hopefully the book is a celebration of that joy we feel and that privilege we feel and also that responsibility we feel to country. This is a joyous thing that all Australians should be celebrating, the knowledges embedded with country and with these senior knowledge holders.
And of course, populations living for those tens and tens and tens of thousands of years successfully on a landscape that wasn't sometimes too forgiving, but it's all in the book. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Robin.
The concept of interdependence reminds us that no nation, no community, and no individual can face the climate crisis alone. It asks us to see our connections to each other, to the natural world, and to the generations that will follow, not as vulnerabilities, but as sources of strength. Interdependence shifts our focus from short-term, self-interested decision-making to shared responsibility and mutual benefit. It is a philosophy long embedded in First Nations knowledge systems, where care for country is inseparable from care for people. Embracing interdependence means sharing technology, pooling resources, and acting collectively across borders. It means recognising that our resilience is measured not by how well the most powerful adapt, but by how well we protect the most vulnerable. In an era of climate disruption, interdependence is not a sentimental ideal. It is a survival strategy. Interdependence Strengthens Democracy. It reminds us that our rights and freedoms are sustained not in isolation, but through the web of relationships we share with others. It calls us to see our fellow citizens not as competitors for scarce resources, but as partners in shaping a fair and cohesive society. When we act with an understanding of interdependence, we value dialogue over division, collaboration over confrontation. We recognise that the health of our democracy depends on trust. Trust that our institutions will act with integrity, and trust that we will extend care and respect across our differences. Interdependence fosters a civic culture where listening is as important as speaking, where compromise is not weakness but wisdom, and where the well-being of each of us is bound to the well-being of all. A just society does not scapegoat the vulnerable. It lifts them, it listens to them, it learns from them. Multiculturalism has brought cultural richness and economic strength. Inclusion has never weakened a society, it has always made it stronger. While permission for racial discrimination still sits within our constitution, it is even more important that we ensure our civil society is strong, just, and inclusive. In a time of increasing geopolitical divisions, we need to value, nurture, and fiercely protect inclusivity and social cohesion. As the divide between rich and poor, especially in relation to intergenerational wealth, continues to feel more pronounced, we need to strongly embrace the values of equality and fairness. We need to celebrate the strengths of our democratic institutions, including our legal system, but we need to continue to increase both its inclusivity and its resilience. The future of Australian democracy lies not just in its courts, but in its classrooms, its cultural institutions, its stories, its creative practices, and its courage to imagine. If we invest in justice and imagination, we invest in a democracy that will outlast us all.
Larissa Berendt, part of her Boyer lecture. And finally, back to main author Billy Griffiths and what seems a paradox. Indigenous students not wanting to be distracted by a European interpretation of how their culture should be linked to the school curriculum, but wanting to do scientific courses like everyone else. Billy, familiar?
Yes, I've heard things like that. And I think whenever there is people go out of the way to do these formal qualifications, to learn a different language, a different scientific language of botany, for example, and then combine it with their own cultural knowledge, it turns into something which is the cutting edge of pharmaceutical innovation or food sovereignty movements or ecological restoration. This combining of knowledge systems is opening up the knowledge bank that is here, that isn't recorded in books, but is preserved through oral history, from memory, through knowledge transmission across an enormous amount of time, but also across this cataclysm of invasion. So it's amazing this knowledge has survived and it's here after all that has happened, and it is being renewed in all sorts of incredibly exciting ways.
What about some of the things that you've looked at before, like the astounding discoveries at Lake Mungo of Mungo man and Mungo woman? I must say that I have been slightly reserved myself about the reburial and thinking, okay, if you've got the actual material, you can make moulds of the skeletons and so on, and there are compromises you can make. And there are UNESCO advice to museums about this, you know, restoration and the loss of material. What stage has that reached?
And the Mungo story is at the heart of the deep history of Australia. It is an extraordinary story, and it is one that continues to open new generations' eyes to this history. It's so vivid because here are people who lived on these enormous mega lakes, which are now dry. And they lived alongside megafauna, coexisted for a long time. They shaped their environments. They had complex lives with ornate ritual. It's an incredibly vivid window into the deep past, into the past of 40,000 years ago. It's extraordinary. A history which should be better known. And I think it's a complex story between the many layered bureaucracies involved and, of course, with the representatives of the Bagangee Nyiyampa and Mardi Mardi peoples.
What would you do if you had this sole decision to make, officer commanding culture in the new government, and you had to make the decision about that sort of unbelievably precious relic? Because it turned the view, you know, 40,000 years ago, there was the evidence, not 4,000, as they told me when I first arrived in Australia for human occupation. And so it went. And what would you do to make a gradual diplomatic decision as to what people would wear?
I would throw money there that way, and I would throw support, and I would throw recognition in that way. I think I would value the history that is there for what it is and value it on equal terms with other things we support, we fund and celebrate. I think if you look at somewhere like Budge Bim in Western Victoria, which has got World Heritage status now and has just benefited from having the tourism, sustainable tourism associated with World Heritage status, is strengthening people to tell stories about this country and inviting more international tourists to understand these incredible eel systems. That is what money can do. And we've got Lake Mungo, which is World Heritage recognised for its cultural values and its natural values. And I think both natural and cultural values need to be taken into account in a management of the area. And I believe it could have greater, much greater government support. How that would manifest on the ground, I'm not sure. I would leave that to the boards that are in place, sure, to the people who have a stake in this place. But there's certainly a tendency to avoid difficult subject matters, avoid doing difficult things. It's easy to rename a place. It's easy to make a token gesture about Indigenous history or culture. It's hard to get in the thick of these individual contexts and bring money, bring time, patiently listen, and build on plans that have been in process for decades.
Billy Griffiths from Deakin University, where he's a senior research fellow and lead author with Sean Ulm and Larissa Berendt of the book The First Inventors, launched this week. Next week we celebrate another unique Australian icon, the echidna. And yes, again, much more complex and surprising than we thought. A big brain, built for thinking, and physically strong enough to move your fridge, would you believe?
I've certainly seen them moving large rocks that were bigger than them. So they're incredibly strong animals. They're very powerful.
One turned up on our steps, stone steps, down the south coast. And I thought, oh gosh, I wonder if it's got lost. And what I'll do is I'll lift it up and put it somewhere else. I could not lift it. It must have had suction feet or something. It's unbudgeable.
They're absolutely unbudgeable. When they want to go, they go, and when they don't want to go, you can't move them. So that's a really well-known characteristic of them. But the interesting thing is an echidna always knows where it needs to be. Chances are it's quite happy where it is. So as long as it's not in any danger, they're best off left to their own, find their own way.
And they live a long time, so do they make social parties, groups of them, or do they stay fairly solitary?
They're generally regarded as pretty solitary, but there are some slightly inexplicable reports of aggregations of them being found from time to time, so we're not quite sure what's going on there. But by and large, they're fairly solitary. I expect their food keeps them distant from one another.
Danielle Claude on the amazing echidna, much more surprising than most of us knew. And also, next week, Bell Smith. Is this unprecedented? Brings an ancient sword to the science show. Could it possibly have once belonged to Lord Nelson?
Been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.